Hi, my name's Frankie Layton, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production by Neural, an agency that helps both brands and talent tell their story. To learn more, just visit neural.com, that's NeurALLE.com. My guest this week, Frankie Layton, founder of The Dirt Company. Recent mother, I hear.
Yes, I am.
And big fan of Dieter Rams.
Yes, that's also true.
I remember Lauren and I started dating when we were like 17, 18. I remember we had this period probably when we were like 19. She just started doing comm design at Swinburne and she was obsessed with Dieter Rams.
Yes.
Absolutely obsessed. Like, we'd be the type of people who would go, there was some sort of exhibition on, and like obsess over his radio design.
Yes, it's unbelievable, wasn't it? When you read his stuff, you were like, this makes so much sense.
This guy is like a god. But yeah. you know that a lot of that stuff would have permeated in that field of design eventually. It's just that he was the guy that came up with it.
Yes, well, I actually found out recently that he wasn't the original guy. That was actually an architect, William someone, who I can't remember before. Well, I felt absolutely cheated, but he did do the 10 principles that I thought were pretty amazing. So.
Yeah. I remember, I'm pretty sure Johnny Ives is like really inspired by that guy.
Yeah.
It makes sense. When you look at like MacBook Pros from that 2000 era, they look like a Dieter Rams product.
They do.
I never understood why like that sort of design didn't continue. Like when it came to design, there was a really shocking period in like the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. Wasn't the more is more approach.
Yeah, the more is more approach. That's what that Hey Whipple Squeeze This book was talking about.
Oh.
Is simplicity is like everything.
Yeah.
In whether it's design, advertising, marketing, whatever. Lauren and I have always had that in common, is like we're not like her parents, maybe that's a generational thing as well. Like I find that my parents are probably, they're not minimalist, but they're not too flamboyant. They're not classical wogs where they've got like, you know, the pillar, marble pillar
statues,
and all that sort of stuff. Like dad's really into, is it Frank Lloyd Wright?
Yeah.
Yeah. They just got a house that was designed in that, his style.
Oh, so amazing.
They're like really, he really likes that sort of, that style of design, but.
It is pretty cool. I mean, I think a lot of what's come from architecture is just like they seem to get it like 30 years before the rest of us do.
Before the trend.
Yeah.
If you want design trends, go for architecture. Do you watch any of those sort of like, I don't know, I'm not sure if you're a big YouTube fan, but like the Architectural Digest sort of shows a huge...
Obviously. I do. I am partial to that sort of stuff. I love grand designs and all those sort of shows. But mostly it's actually the building part of that really fascinates me, like just how it's all put together.
Is it the story of it, or like the trials and
Yeah, and then sometimes these people have these ideas and you just think like, oh, how's that going to work? Yeah. And then sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. So I love following that kind of journey through.
It is like I'm pretty sure grand designs – or there was a show like Grand Designs, but it was only for period homes that had to be refurbed in the UK, or they came under sort of like some sort of law where you could not knock it down and it had to be built a certain way or something like that, some sort of heritage.
Yeah.
And, yeah, man, that was a real show, like because in a lot of the cases people just had like real life problems. Like I remember one of the people one of the partners like passed away. She got like cancer and passed away during the build process.
Oh, that's so sad. And it was a dream home.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes me sad.
Yeah. So that's just life. And I feel like those sorts of shows are really good like that.
Yeah, that's true.
Speaking of life, I know you're a bit of an ocean baby at heart.
Yes.
What's sort of your earliest memory of going to the beach?
Oh, to be honest, it's probably being cold. We went to the beach a lot at Wilson's Prom when we were growing up. So it's pretty chilly down there. So I'd say my earliest memory is probably like those days of walking along the beach in the freezing cold, and we used to go up around the rocks and just being ice cold at the end of the day. But, I mean, I loved it. It was exploring the oceans. And back then, you know, with down at Walkerville, there's beautiful blue pools with lots of starfish and fish and cucumbers you used to squeeze and all the rest of it. So they're my early ocean memories.
So did you – so it sounds like you not so much the beach was part of the process, but it sounds like – because I used to have this thing with playing soccer during winter in Melbourne. It was always really wet and rainy.
Yeah.
And you'd get numb hands.
Yeah.
And so the best part of it was actually coming home and having like a warm shower.
Yeah. Yeah, the post-ocean days.
The post-ocean, yeah. Like that.
For sure.
Because there is something about coldness that, like, it really, like, you know, like how Wim Hof is huge now?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel like there was something that we didn't realise as kids that we did from that cold, and it was nice and refreshing, and then you get to have that shower.
Yeah.
And chill out.
God, first to the shower. That was a big deal if you got in first, because we also had limited hot water at the shack. So, yeah, you had to be quick. You had to get in first. And if you were fourth, there was just no way you were done. Getting warm. No. That was it for the day.
What did you think you were going to be when you were a kid?
I was pretty sure I was going to be a dolphin trainer, actually. I was pretty sure right up until I was maybe 15 or so. And that's when I learned about animals in captivity.
Right.
And that was like the realization that the animals weren't having fun really knocked out the idea of that profession for me.
When was there a doco or something that?
No, I mean, the Cove was probably really busted it right open for me. I don't know if you ever saw the Cove.
Was that the one about the killer whales?
In Japan. No, sorry, that was bluefish.
Bluefish or blackfish.
Blackfish, maybe. Yeah, that was the killer whales. Cove was about the dolphin fishing in Japan.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, how they sold the dolphins off to captivity and all the rest of it. But, no, I think that was just through my own research. I was really serious about being a dolphin trainer.
Really?
I've just always loved the ocean, always loved dolphins, and just thought that is the best profession I could possibly think of, getting in the water every day, playing with dolphins who want to be there. And then it was when I found out that they probably didn't want to be there, that was a real spanner in the works for that plan.
What was that like, as in, did you think, okay, I'm not going to have anything to do with dolphins at all?
No, I then went on to decide I was going to be a marine biologist instead, yeah.
I remember having a similar belief, and then I feel like I was like 16, 17, and then I realised that your options were you had to go to Tassie to study. I don't know if there was a course here in Melbourne.
I
probably wasn't as smart as maybe, not smart, but like I wasn't performing as well at school as what you probably needed to do that.
Or also that you become a white lab. Like the profession itself is white lab. That for me was where marine biology fell down. I was like, no, but I just want to swim with dolphins. And so if they're not going to pay me to do that, I have to do the science as well. Then I mean, I love the idea of marine biology and all that stuff, but it is really research science.
Hmm.
And if you're a creative person that needs to grow and build things, that is probably a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how, like, when you're a kid, like, to look back in hindsight and how much most of growing up is just discovering your naivety.
Yeah, exactly.
If I think about the whole marine biology thing, I've got a feeling that I would have had probably a similar belief that you did. It's just like, well, I like fish.
Yeah, so, exactly.
You know, I'll be doing this thing with fish, but really what you're doing is you're dissecting fish and discovering what it is that may problems that may exist in different environments for different animals. And yeah, you're interested by that, but really what you like is being in the ocean with fish.
Exactly. And you can probably have a job and then do that on the weekends
and
keep them both fun.
Yeah. Was there a lesson growing up that you sort of learnt, a principle or something like that, from your parents or grandparents at all that sort of stuck with you today?
Just generally?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess this probably happened a bit later when I was living in Germany, but my grandma made a comment that was along the lines of, isn't it amazing what you've been able to achieve because of the net that you've grown up in?
Mm.
And that for me was probably the biggest learning curve and what I want to pass on to my children as well. She's right in that I had these ideas about what I wanted to do, And I had no fear to pursue them because the way that I grew up, I was fortunate enough just to know that, you know, if that didn't work, you could do the next thing.
Yeah.
And so even probably the privilege of deciding what you want to be in a career and all that, it came from just that feeling of security that my parents gave me, which no matter what you do when you go forward, will be here if you need to fall back for a bit.
Yeah.
And then you can go forward again. And that was probably my big sort of family epiphany where, and the thing that I just take into being a family as well. It's like, it doesn't matter in what setting you grow up in, but to be able to give your kids that feeling of security and you can do whatever you want. Mm. That is an amazing platform to start your life from.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the one lesson that I took out.
Yeah. Do you think that you had that because your parents worked hard? Like, I know that for my parents, I feel like I was having this discussion with someone the other day, like, you really didn't have a lot of options. You just had to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure Dad wanted to be a mechanic, but he just didn't want to be a printer, or he did that. Didn't want to be that. He wanted to be a builder, actually, and he has always loved property and houses. Yeah. And he just couldn't find a job because of, at the time, there was like a real downturn in property. And so the only thing he could do was find a job with his dad as a printer.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess there was an element of sacrifice that my parents made, but also an element of working together that I think made them enjoy. You know, they got the pros and the cons with the sacrifice as well. So, I mean, hard work runs in our family, but we're all really into doing stuff. So I can't picture a world where, you know, we all sat around for a weekend and had a good time.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I guess that's
a common thing along with most people we interview is that, and it becomes part of your personality.
Yeah, for sure.
Like for me, I didn't like think of it intuitively, but I know that my parents worked really hard.
Yeah.
Because it was like, where's Dad? We don't see Dad at night. Like, this is different to other parents.
Yeah.
And then over time, you know, you go into their work or see something like that. And then it's not until you're like nearly 30 that you realize, oh, okay, that's what.
He was actually pretty easy.
Like, and, you know, you start doing the things that they do, the same habits, and like you understand what your friends are doing in comparison, and you realize, okay, that is different.
Yeah.
And it does set you up well, I think.
Yeah.
On Germany, I know, so I had here Campbell Gill's grandma, there was some sort of. It's so funny when you like search people's names and what comes up.
Yes,
the old grammarians? Like, I've got the same thing. My brother and I went to Brighton Grammar because he got a scholarship. Like, he's exceptionally smart.
Yeah.
And so that was like the main reason I went there. And they always post about like old. They tag onto the old grammarians.
Doing, did
like,
you find really, an like, old grammarian?
There was like a post about the dirt and how. Sally Cap. Was like, they had some video on LinkedIn of her talking about the dirt or something like that. So they posted about that.
Classic.
So you did your undergrad, Bachelor of Arts, Marketing and PR.
Yeah.
So that was 2010. I think you went from uni straight to Hamburg.
Yeah.
How did the Germany thing come about?
I was following my heart.
Okay.
Yeah. So I did my year overseas, my gap year, and kind of fell in love with being not in Melbourne.
Okay.
And that was when I did the super yachts and that chapter of my life. And then came back, I had 4 years of uni planned ahead of me in a very science-heavy degree. Mm. And I said, I've just got to get through uni as fast as possible. So that's when I called the uni and said, what can I do really fast? I need a degree, but I want to make it as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And they said Bachelor of Arts is probably the fastest you can get through. That's how I ended up doing arts. And then because I chose an arts where it's, I mean, it was such a blessing because you just learn what you enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, I had criminology, psychology, Spanish, like no link between kind of my early subject choices. And then, they allowed me to do the last semester overseas.
Okay, so you got to, that was why Hamburg came up.
Yeah, and so I just thought, let's just go finish uni in Germany, which actually turned out to be a really fun thing to do because I was very good at not doing much in Melbourne. But when you have that, when you have all context removed, you don't really know what people are talking about at uni anymore. You know, I had to actually do the work in the last semester quite heavily. And that was when I really fell in love with marketing because all my final subjects were kind of sports marketing and marketing science and PR. And yeah, so that was really fun. And I got really into uni, whereas previously I'd been like, yep, lecture 13. I just read that one, go to the exam, we'll be fine.
You're right.
Get through it. So yeah, it was, I was following my heart over there. Germany was kind of a destination that I'd never thought of living, but that's where my boyfriend at the time was from and he needed to finish his uni and I could do mine over there. So off I went.
So Hamburg, was where his, because Hamburg's not a massive, it's a big city, but it's not a massive city.
Yeah.
Like it's regionally big, right?
Yeah. It's, I mean, in German context, yes. But we actually started in Berlin. Yeah. We did a year or so in Berlin and then moved to Hamburg. And Berlin's like an international island in the middle of Germany.
It really is.
Hamburg's German.
Hamburg is very, very German. Yeah. Lauren's family's German, like particularly Pomeranian, and for whatever reason they've had this strong connection with Hamburg because of family friends. So they had a few like backpackers or exchange students come over from Hamburg.
Yeah.
And we've been to Hamburg on the way to Copenhagen.
Oh, amazing.
It's a great city.
Yeah, it's cool. It's amazing.
Very I was trying to think because Lübeck is where her parents, her grandparents got married and it's really famous for marzipan.
Right.
But it's not far from Hamburg and so you get like quite a bit of marzipan in Hamburg.
Yeah, you definitely do.
Yeah.
They don't hold back on the marzipan. Like, and I'm not the biggest fan.
Meatballs, marzipan.
It was on everything.
Yeah, it was pretty much on everything. But yeah, there's two girls in particular I'm thinking of that stayed with Lauren's parents like a while after she'd moved out and because we were meant to be getting married in October and we'd hoped we'd do a tour of like where my family's from, where her family's from and go back to the north of Germany.
Yeah.
But we haven't been able to do that, which
sucks. Oh, that sucks.
But Hamburg is definitely on the menu.
Yeah, I think it's great. It's not a tourist town, which is also really nice. I mean, for Germans it is, but not for international travellers.
Yeah, it's more because Hamburg and Bremen – is Hamburg, would you consider that like a, is there a port there or is it just in Bremen? Yeah.
Yeah, it's that like their identity is.
Is the port.
Is the port,
Yeah, it's, because that thing is like, I think that's what's lost about a lot of Germany is people go to the cliche places, like you go to Bavaria, go to Berlin, have to.
Yeah.
And the sort of the western part near France, so your Cologne's, et cetera. Yeah. So she's got family in Cologne and Frankfurt and Leipzig.
Oh, yeah.
And then these family friends that are in Hamburg. We've been lucky enough to do a lot of, like, the northern parts but also see other parts as well, I think.
Yeah. It's look, I would really recommend it if anyone's going there. You sort of – it's the sailor town, so it's got the Reeper Barn, but it's pretty, like, untouched, the Reeper Barn. So it's still like a mind-boggling experience. And then you've got the Schanze, which is like this amazing party area. And then you've got the port, which is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's cold.
It's cold, yeah.
You've got the Elbe, so everyone kind of walks and picnics around the lake. It's got just like, it's a good living place.
Yeah, it's that place where it's a weird mesh between Germanicness and Scandinavian-ness.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
There are similar traditions there. Like these girls, remember, they did their graduation and everyone in graduation in Scandinavia wears like these sailor hats.
Right.
Like it looks like a captain's hat as part of their graduation party. I can't remember what it's called, but they have the same thing in Hamburg.
Right.
Which I found really interesting.
Yeah, so, it's a sailor's town. You really feel that when you're there.
Okay, so you're in Germany. You had this role, which is really interesting. You obviously really stuck away there, Schultz and Friends.
Yeah.
So you went from really intern to strategist, came back to Melbourne 2013, and then you worked at Love and Money, Ogilvy Mather, and then finally at Tank in sort of like a, seems like a freelance role.
Yeah.
Again, all the time working as a strategist.
Yeah.
Do you look back at that whole period in agency land and think there are some key principles or lessons that stand with you today and how you operate the business?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, agency, I would really recommend it as a training ground for anybody who wants to go into business, because the whole learning how to understand consumers, it takes a minute, and then learning how to understand competitors takes a minute as well. And then obviously there's such a high creative energy that surrounds you in agency land. So like problem solving is everybody's jam.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're a creative or a suit or a strategist, or, you know, everybody loved a big problem. And so they're all kind of like the working principles that I'm really glad we took over. But apart from that, like especially as I got more senior in my role, speaking with marketing people and understanding their problem, you know, marketing's often the first department that will understand that there is a problem out there. And, you know, what will happen is a CMO will try and fix it 3 or 4 times, and they can churn through CMOs until somebody will maybe admit that there might be a product problem or the rest of it. But so the CMOs being on the front line of these big problems, some of them were problems related to, I can't understand my customer because my distributor holds their relationship with their customers really tightly and they sell my products, so I just have to swallow whatever the distributor is telling me to do. And so that was like a check, you know, we need to make sure that we can understand our customers when we have it. And then another thing that was really emerging in probably the early 2010s was, you know, oh, we need to have a purpose. So we would go into these workshops where we would try and find a company's purpose. And like the fact is, if you don't have a purpose other than to make money, you don't have a purpose. And kind of the veil was up on that, and consumers weren't swallowing like, you know, my insurance company's purpose is to make me feel whatever. You know, they know the insurance company's purpose is to pay when something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And so all these kind of ethereal notions of what is our why, and Simon Sinek just come out and says, it's not what you do, it's why you do it. And everyone in the marketing department's going, why do we do this? Yeah. We've got to find our why. And that was like a really interesting lesson for me as well, because I think even now when you see businesses that have purposes for the sake of making money, I think consumers are onto that as well.
Yeah.
You have to kind of be quite authentic in you believe what you're trying to change.
But also that, what you were saying before, you can't sell people to this oftentimes grand idea. Sometimes you're just a chocolate company that makes chocolate and it makes you feel good sitting on the couch.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And I actually noticed that in the way that you guys market, you talk about the higher level things, but also you don't shy away from the fact of like, what's the cost per wash?
Yeah.
So that's a thing like I just saw as an outsider that you probably picked up from being in agency land.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of businesses, and that sort of comes down to positioning, they always forget about positioning.
Yeah.
They're just like, oh, we're this company and this is that, and they worry about what their competitors do. But what makes you sort of different?
What does make us different?
Yeah, why would you buy, you know, this versus this? And that's something that I think you've gotten right pretty well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we are purpose-led almost to our own detriment sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, we can lose days in the warehouse experimenting with recycling plastic or what we're going to do with the next product design. And, you know, if anyone else that was an actual business person got their hands on the business, they'd probably say, just sell more product. You should all be thinking about, you know, selling more product at this time. But that's the interest base of almost everybody that works for us as well. So laundry detergent for us felt like we really cracked the code on how to create a green formula that really worked in a high concentrate level. And so that was obviously a price of entry to our success. But we wanted product that was beautiful, that people could fall in love with, but we also needed product that really worked. And then above all, we wanted people to understand that this is not a set and forget company. This is a company that's working towards trying to reduce plastic waste and trying to tackle it from a lot of different angles. And laundry is what we do right now. Laundry may not be the only thing we do in the future if we find more ways to move where we feel we can have big impact and so on and so forth. So I think for us, it's like we had to get those, what I considered the ticket to entry, a low cost per wash, a great formula, beautiful design, functional design, great convenience. All those things were kind of our price of entry. And then that other stuff that we work on, which is the stuff that we can just lose our minds in for days. But our customers love being on the journey of success as much as they do of our failures.
Yeah. Well, when I was looking at these bottles, I thought, you know what we should have done? We should have placed it next to, we've got like sort of one of those green, supposedly green sort of wash type things. Because Lauren's got sensitive skin as well. And I find like washing is one of those things. It's so interesting that you saw, like, if you go on that aisle, it's a shit show.
Yeah.
Like, it totally. Really fucking is. Yeah. Like, she'll tell me, because I do the shopping, I love to cook, you know, just in, you know, cooking trees.
Yeah.
Most woggy thing ever. Yeah. But that's my shtick. But it is really weird if you look at the containers in comparison, they're so blocky.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you go, fuck, like, you're really right. Like, if you look at this thing, it's so slim. In comparison, you can already tell even the thickness of the plastic.
Yeah.
There's so much of it.
There's so much of it. It's so awful.
The thing is, you don't realize until you see the comparison.
Yeah.
And that's where the positioning thing comes in. Yeah.
I think it's a hangover from the more is more world.
Yeah.
I saw this ad the other day that was on the front of the Time magazine in like 1970 or something, and it was when polystyrene, everyone just got their hands on polystyrene, and it was this ad of like this housewife and her madman advertising looking husband and their little kids, and they're all on a bench and they were all throwing this polystyrene in the air, like huge amounts of it, and it was like, the future of convenience is here. And this is like the title of the Time magazine, and you just thought, shit, how fast, like, you know, that whole idea of we can just throw out whatever we want just goes away
whenever. Yeah,
yeah. And it continued right up into the 90s, and then it was just halt that ship.
Well, do you,
stuff's got to go somewhere.
Do you remember, you've seen Mad Men?
Yeah.
Okay, do you remember there was an episode where they're at a park and they're having like a family picnic and the main guy's just having a beer and they're drinking or eating whatever, and there's just all this rubbish that they just leave. Yeah. And it's like,
and then they just go.
That was like, okay then. It's like what you found during the process of working out this idea of the dirt. You know, this idea when you're in the super yachts and people would just dump rubbish.
Yeah.
Was crazy. And I remember a similar thing because we went to Turkey in sort of 2012 or 13. So this was just before the law came in. And I remember thinking, like, we saw people dumping rubbish.
Yeah.
And because my dad's business is, his whole business, I think, is like 100%. As a printer, green. So, like, everything is recycled from paper to plastic to whatever.
Yeah.
The whole roof is covered in solar.
Nice.
So it's like this enclosed sort of loop system. Yeah. And that's how they've been able to maintain a competitive advantage because, you know, a Qantas or someone will come to them for a print job and they can say, well, it's 100% carbon neutral. And he was just like, he's always been so finicky about recycling.
Yeah.
He's like, don't go
recycling. Did you ever get the gold stars from the council?
No, but like my dad is the type of person, like we'd have the three bins, right?
Yeah.
The veggie, recycling, normal. But we also had like a specialised paper bin.
Yeah.
Because he would bring it in to work and put it in part of the recycling and stuff like that. I just had a really interesting idea for an ad for you guys. I have to show you. We did this ad recently for our social media advertising, and so we created a bunch of like four different types of creative for two different demographics.
Yeah.
And it's basically similar design, like a beautiful bottle.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of like an Aesop type bottle.
Yeah.
And it's the theme is with us, without us, right?
Yeah.
So the without us before and is basically like a bottle in sand washing up on the beach.
Yeah.
It looks really messy and gross and not hygienic and bad for the environment. And then the other bottle is just like really perfect looking.
Yeah.
And that is our best performing ad. And I just thought like the perfect ad is a nondescript bottle just literally washing up on like Brighton Beach versus
this. Yeah, we'll stay in your home forever.
Yeah.
I like it.
It's
we'll bake something together on social and see what it does.
You can have it, but I just think that looking at the bottle, like that was the first thing that came to my mind.
Yeah.
In particular.
It's a different experience to what you'd expect in laundry.
Yeah. You. Yes, you. Are you intrigued by this episode? If so, go to our footer on the website, neurallee.com, neural.com.
We're going to give you an insight each week. It's going to be on business, marketing, or a topic that we covered in the episode at all. We'd love your support, and it would help us in developing the intellect around this series. But without going on too much longer, let's get back into this episode.
So the dirt, I know you were doing, you're doing 4 days, obviously, in agency land, a day a week, working on this thing for two years, and then eventually you're like, okay, I've got to do this full time. So it's probably 2017 that you sort of had the epiphany walking down the aisle, the same thing I've wondered. You did your research very well, obviously. You went through the whole chemistry experience, which would have been interesting.
Yeah, that's so fun.
What did I have here? I wrote here true marketer's brain there around the fact that you said there was no real brand loyalty in the cleaning. It's true. Like, the thing that I look at oftentimes is like, okay, get a sensitive skin thing and what's the cost per litre or milliliter or grams or whatever.
And
there's a lot of things in each aisles that you do with.
It's so well hidden. So this is 32 loads.
Yeah.
That you'll get a jug that can be twice the size and will be 11 loads. So you'll compare them on a price basis or even a cost per mil basis.
Yeah.
And you're going to think the jug's cheaper.
Yeah.
But you're going to get home, you're going to burn through that stuff so fast.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what happened to me when I started to think about concentrates. We'd been at a festival. My housemate did her laundry first and I went and bought laundry detergent. And by the time it was my turn, there's like no laundry detergent left. Like, what the hell? I just bought this like a week ago. And that's where it really gets really interesting in kind of the affordability. So one thing that surprises people is they think they're buying more expensive laundry detergent. They get down the road and they realise it was far cheaper in the long run, because we're helping everyone measure their dosage with the pump, and it's just economical.
Still pretty well priced if, you match it on that basis. But even when you look at those bottles, like, they're not exactly cheap. And we've had this thing recently because we're trying to work out what, I think you covered it in an interview where you spoke about like the dosage.
Yeah.
So we've gone from like, it is a real fine thing because we've done it where you put in too much and the thing has completely like soap suds everywhere.
Yeah.
And it just smells of chemicals.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've been trying to find that balance, and it's hard.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the pump is a great innovation. There's a reason manufacturers don't use them, and that's because you have to be careful with them. They're not easy to ship around roughly, which has been a challenge for us. But once the consumer's got them and they're working, they're so good.
So when did you realise that the stress of the opportunity was less than the potential downside of starting a business?
Oh gosh, when will I realise? I'm not sure. It's a work in progress.
Because I'd imagine you'd be sitting there thinking, like, there's got to be a point where you really have like a lot of conviction about this thing.
Yeah.
And I just wonder where that was.
It never came in a way in that way. I was talking to a friend of mine trying to understand this same question. He has his own business. And he said, if you keep one foot in the door and one foot out the door, you'll be limited in the success that you can create with the business. So what had happened is I'd quit my 4 day a week job because I couldn't do 3 or 2 days a week, you know, and still maintain that level of service. I quit for 2 weeks. I panicked. And then I went and did freelancing 3 days a week instead of working on the company. And the company had grown, it had grown quite substantially throughout the year, but we were still doing like, I don't know, $5,000 in monthly revenue. It wasn't huge. Not enough to support, but our basket size was low, so I had to do a lot of late night packing and dealing with customer inquiries and, you know, all the rest of it. And I got to kind of breaking point with, I was flying to Adelaide for my freelancing job at the time, so I was kind of on the plane early in the morning, off the plane late at night, back to packing. I can remember one time I had to get some chemicals ordered to my doorstep because it was just a logistics nightmare and I had to go to Adelaide. So I had to get an airtasker to come in and sit on my doorstep to sign for some chemicals. And when he rolled up, he did not look like a sober person. And I was like, it's cool. I've just left this guy that looks like a bit dubious, sitting on my doorstep,
oh my God,
ready to sign for like a barrel of, I don't know what it was, enzymes or something. So I called my partner and said, like, if you get a call from the police today, just tell them I was just getting some enzymes delivered from. Anyway, so there was that whole rigmarole of trying to do it both. And then I really just went down. I've always, when I've had hit points of cross points, I've just tried to speak to as many people as I can about my problems.
Yeah.
And he was really great, and he said, you've got to put yourself in so deep, it'll cost you more to lose than it will to succeed. And so I said, all right, what's the limit of how much I can lose before I start to send our life backwards? And decided 6 months without working was what I was going to do. So I did, and I had a revenue target in mind, which is still humble. Like, if in 6 months I can make this, earn $20,000 a month, then I'm going to do it. Then I know it's an idea with legs that I'm going to commit to. And we did it inside three. And yeah, the difference was only that I was focused on it full time.
Yeah.
And before that, I was just doing it at the end of every day.
So you felt like probably during that period, although you were probably working comparative hours, the context switching didn't apply as much stress for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just, you know, if you blow something up, it'll succeed quickly or fail quickly. You'll know if you dribble along at it, you might not even know whether it's succeeding or failing at that time. So I just thought that was great advice, because at the end of the day, I think any business can be successful. It just depends on how long your runway is.
Yeah.
And for us, it was just a balance of how much we were willing to put in before we understood if it was going to be successful or not. And, you know, the day that we hit profitability and the day that we made a dollar, they were like, that was everything I worked for in those first 2 years.
Why do you think you not freaked out, but you worried during that period and went back to freelance? Was it the uncertainty,
say? It was the uncertainty. So our launch was not particularly well planned. We accidentally left the holding site unlocked overnight and got a sale. And then speaking to my co-founder, I was like, well, do we just launch since we've already got a sale?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, can you send something today? And I was like, running around the ring road, if you ever need actual hard product, the ring road's your place to do it. Getting boxes, calling Sendal, trying to work out how that whole thing worked. And that's how we launched. And so we didn't have, like, my plan was to work on a big pre-launch and do a big bang and all the rest of it. Then all of a sudden we just accidentally put the product on the internet and away we were. So we sold like 25 in our first day, and then it was like 20, and then it was like 7, and then it was getting down to these numbers that I thought, far out, is this a failure? And that's what I freaked out by, because it was, yeah, you know, when everybody started sharing it and it was working really well. And then it probably took me that next 6 months of doing both to realize, if you build a beautiful product and put it in a cave, no one's going to find it.
Yeah, yeah.
We hadn't done any marketing.
Yeah.
And I was the marketer. So it surprised me that it took me that long to realize that you probably need that other side to be churning as well. So that was just slowly building up, learning things like Facebook advertising. Like, we hadn't done any of that. We didn't know about it. You know, and getting little bits of traction through stories and everything. And the whole business is dependent upon repeat customers. And so we didn't have any at that time, because it takes people a certain amount of time to get through their first run of laundry detergent. So it was all that sort of stuff that freaked me out, that I just thought, shit, I don't know if this is going to work. And also an instant loss of income.
Yeah.
That was like a bitter pill to swallow.
But that's also like a thing that I feel like a lot of new entrepreneurs realise in the early days. Like, I remember you had this note in a prior interview about, yes, you're growing really quickly. I think it was between June and February after the launch.
Yeah.
Like, I think the number was 30% each month.
Yeah.
But what you don't realise when you're a founder is how much, like, at least in the first few months, so you know, you can have all these numbers like customer acquisition costs and long-term value.
Yeah.
But you don't actually realise what the cost means to the business in the short term until you get that LTV. Like, they actually have to then
come back.
Come back and purchase to make that effective.
Yeah.
Which is the hard part.
Yeah. I would say to any founder out there who's selling a product-based business, you'll have your capital to get through your first run. You'll have to scrounge for it again to get through your second run of product. And you'll have to fight for your life to get through your third run. And once you're through your third, it's easier.
Yeah.
So I think everybody thinks, this is how much money I'm going to need to buy the first one. and you'll have that money because you would have calculated it when you calculated how much your business would cost. Buy your second one, you don't have enough customers, your operational costs are high, you know, especially if you've moved in somewhere and you're not doing it at home.
Yeah, bring on new staff.
You've got new staff, you've got marketing, you've got all these other things. You have to buy your second one, but you banked in your plan on using the money you made from your first ones to buy your second ones. But that money doesn't exist in your business. It just doesn't. And this is consistent with everybody who I've spoken to. The second one, everyone's like, whoa, hang on, weren't we supposed to make money?
Yeah.
And you laugh and you get through it. And the third one, I remember saying, have we got a zombie business? I just feel like the more money we make, the more money we need to make money. And we actually had to get a guy in that was a finance guy. Because at that stage we were thinking like, how does this even work? And he came in and he said, you've got 2 months to go till you make money. You just need to grow this much more and then you've got 2 months to go and then it's all going to go green.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, well, you better be right. Yeah. And he was. And, yeah, then I spoke to two other founders that said exactly the same thing. Some say it in years, like your first, second and third year are your hardest. And in that order, like your 30s is your hard, hard year and then you're out of the woods.
Yeah.
But for us it was runs of product.
Yeah, and I think at that time you sort of learned that the basket size thing was going to be crucial in the future.
Yeah.
And how now have you thought about, I guess, marketing strategy and the way that goes? Is do you think instead of just increasing, oh, we should just put more ad spend here or more ads here or there, you just go, okay, well, we should just pour more money into developing new products here and here that would make people increase that basket size?
It's always a juggle because for us affordability is really important and we don't want to remove the option for people to just buy laundry detergent at a really reasonable price that's delivered if that's what they want to do. And so the reason we didn't go and develop out a whole range and then create clever bundles that work for the business was because often that doesn't work for the customer and especially not in the long term. We're certainly working on that approach slowly, but just making sure it's value-adding each time and it makes sense within the range. But, yes, definitely like ad spend and increasing ad spend is a great way to get new customers, but for us also finding ways to really delight the customers that we've got is also really important. So little collaborations or little extra products that can go in subscription, that sort of thing for us I think will be a really important part of you know, because we're not funded by capital, we're bootstrapped, it means that we have to do everything that we do, it has to come from money that's within the business, which means that whole idea of winning the market by buying the most customers is really off the table for us. It has to be about nurturing the best customer relationships with the best product. And, you know, in that way, we've stayed solid. And so I think that'll be kind of going forward, that'll be
I found that really interesting, but the bootstrapping thing is like a lot of founders now are sort of skipping that frothy VC money.
Yeah.
And it's giving you a lot more. Look, it depends because we interviewed Simon from Who Gives a Crap maybe a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And in the sort of businesses that you guys are in, I think you absolutely, like VC money makes no sense whatsoever. But I also think that people are starting to realise that generally.
Yeah.
It's actually more rewarding. Like in the short term, it's more painful maybe.
Yeah.
But in the long term, it's far more rewarding for the people who found the business and the staff as well. Because those extra numbers of margin that maybe a VC would push you to hire more staff, et cetera. Well, actually, you can create a better lifestyle for the people that are in the business in the process.
Yeah. That would be, I mean, I do think VC money has its time and its place. And if we wanted to rapidly scale or go global expansion or something, you know, we'd be looking there as much as anywhere else. But for us, somebody once told me when we were debating funding, it's like deciding you want to be a rock star and picking up a guitar for your first guitar lesson.
Yeah.
That's what VC funding is. Your chances of actually making it as a business, you should consider as the same as if you decide to get a guitar lesson because you wanted to be the next Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I was it is very, that's low.
No, it is. That's very, very true.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, and that's sometimes why a lot of those businesses sink is because really, the issue was they just didn't have enough bandwidth and time to figure out
Yeah.
What really was the right fit.
Yeah, and you can cushion problems with money. But if you don't understand your problems, you can't fix them. And I think that's a big danger of having a lot of money in the beginning, and you're spending here and you're spending there and you're spending there. Then when you hit your real problems, which will happen once you need to be making money, which is something you need to do. Well, sometimes you don't if that's the kind of business you're setting up. But, you know, you need to understand where your money's going and where your bucket's got holes. And that's not so easy if your bucket's so full.
Yeah.
It's spilling over the sides anyway.
And, yeah, and if people are pushing you to not worry about that and just focus on the growth item.
Exactly.
So, sometimes that is the issue.
Yeah.
I found it interesting, the subscription direct-to-consumer focus is really interesting. I know, obviously, who gives a crap? They sort of proved that out. They also proved out that you could do this model of social enterprise in a way. We were speaking about bottomless subscriptions before.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you sort of had this lesson early on, which at the time it sort of sounds like you weren't too happy about. Like you were told basically from someone that you had to have money to just go and start this youth foundation idea that you had at the time.
Yes, yeah.
And it had me thinking, it was sort of the similar time that effective altruism became a thing. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so how key was the sort of donation element to you when you launched the business? Was it like one of the first things you thought about, or was it like, okay, this idea that I've always had in my head is cool and now I've got a thing I can do it with?
Yeah, it was key. I believe that in the past, you made a lot of money and you donated to charity, and that was kind of the equivalent of doing good. And so the conversation that you're talking about was actually the owner of the super yacht I worked on. He was a billionaire, and he said, well, why are you going to go do charity? Don't do charity, because you'll spend your life looking for money so that you can run your business and you won't get much time to actually do good.
Yeah.
It'll be all about getting donations, which I thought was a valid point, but also a little bit old school. I think that what Who Gives a Crap kind of paved the way for was a new type of business that went like, our number one objective isn't grow at all costs and make as much money as we can. We want to do good, and even as a way of keeping ourselves in check and making sure that the purpose does lie at the heart of the business. Profits were really important to me, giving those profits away. We've discussed throughout the journey, you know, do we change it to a percentage of revenue? Because, you know, to have profits, to have a profit figure that's consistent to the customer, you have to be careful about the way you manage profits. And for us, we want to invest a lot next year in a lot of plastic recycling projects that we're working on at the moment. That means taking money from the profits, right?
Yeah.
So for us, we've got this thing where we internally just say 50% of the money we make has to be used to make sure that we're always in pursuit of the reason that this business was started and the reason that it makes us happy. And the other 50% of the profits can be used in the conventional things that you'd use profits for, which is selling more product and R&D. Giving people bonuses. But at least 50% of the money we're making has to be allocated in that way. So for us, the actual profit donation figure has become less of a focus, even though we will always give the remaining 50% of the remaining money left over. But we have really strict guidelines inside the business of at least 25% of what we think we made this year is going into kitchen bench recycling programs that we've got happening in the warehouse. So there's all that sort of stuff. So I do think that the 50% profit donation model was really important to me in the beginning, in the way that it's less important to me now. I'm really happy to be giving away 50% of the profits to tackling the problem from a different angle, but that was a way of proving that we were about actually doing good.
Yeah.
And now you walk into the business every day and the things that we get to work on, it's like there's no doubt in my mind that there's an authenticity around around trying to solve this problem that exists in every one of our staff, and therefore I relax a little bit on it's about the donations and going, this is all big part of what the purpose is.
Well, just on the point of that billionaire, he probably, without realising it, hit on a point that Simon realises that a lot of the time when you are raising money, it's not very cost effective.
Yeah.
Like, and it is more... Maybe it is more effective becoming wealthy and then donating that as your pursuit.
Yeah.
Because I think he realised he did this study at uni, and like 30% of the money that is donated is then used to raise more money.
Yeah.
So it's not a scalable operation, and that's where he found sort of effective altruism and this idea of the social enterprise.
Yeah.
That was a big trend during that era.
Yeah. Which I think is, I mean, especially for the charities that they have, they get to rely on who gives a crap, you know, to survive. And that just takes so much pressure for them. They can actually focus on what they're trying to do. But I love the way they're moving their initiatives around a little bit to try and get into more sustaining initiatives, because I think that's, you know, charity is a little bit old school in the idea of people give money, you spend money. Remember another example, when I was at Schultz and Friends, we started this thing called Task Force, which was just two of us that used to work late at night and have fun thinking about all the ways we could change the world. But we convinced the agency to let us take a portion of the basically the awards budget, which was huge in a big advertising agency, which is just money they pay to get creatives to think of great ideas that might win a lion.
Yeah.
And if you win a line, it's the best PR you can get for an agency. Yeah. So there's a big budget. And we said, what if we could instead take that money and position it to projects that needed advertising support or needed help? And you might still win an award, but at least you're directing your energy towards doing something that still has a positive outcome in the meantime. This was the idea behind Task Force. And we got on the phone to a guy who was at the time the BBC's head correspondent for West Africa. And we said, so we've got this money and we want to do some charity. And he was like, oh, he's like, sorry, I've had a really long day, but I mean, we just don't need more of that here in West Africa. He said, we see time and time again, these charities, they bring bags of rice in, and they bring bags of rice every day into this part of the world. And they do it for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And so the whole community comes dependent on this charity when it should be the government's job to actually be creating the infrastructure that can support these people. Then these people, they turn 60 or they turn 70, they retire, they're sick of this life driving around in their four-wheel drives, and they go back home. And then this community, which has had a reliance on bags of rice being dropped off by this charity. And he said this isn't without exception. He loved the Red Cross and UNICEF and some of those charities that really provide that fundamental life support that the government probably doesn't have the infrastructure to be able to do in the immediate term. But I've never been able to get that out of my head, and it's why we donate to research, not to charity in itself, because there is that problem of if you step in and try and take the role that a government should be having, then you're giving the government the opportunity to rest on their laurels while the problem is getting taken care of.
And siphon that money elsewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so for me, I think that the idea of where I consider charity and where I consider our profits to go into research and development, plastic is a global problem and the oceans belong to no one, which means it's a field that actually does need people that just care, because no government is responsible for the ocean. There almost should be a government of the ocean, but there's not at this stage. And so that for us is where I think it's most interesting to make sure, like, we are committed to cleaning up those oceans, and the kind of products that really damage them are wasteful ideas like laundry jugs. And, you know, even if it's made out of recycled plastic degrades when it gets recycled again. So you can turn one thing into something that's solid the next time, that's a little bit less solid the next time. And by the end of probably three or four cycles, you're talking about making plastic bags out of recycled plastic. Yeah. We don't need plastic bags in our lives.
Yeah.
So it's that whole, like, the whole problem of trying to work out Plastic has a role, and I think it's got an important and very functional role. But the whole dealing with plastic, you know, we've overused it, we've gone to an over-convenient society, and we haven't figured out mechanisms to keep that same convenience but take out the things that are damaging.
Yeah. Who's that young boy that's got that, like he might be in his early 20s or maybe even like 18, he's got that ocean cleanup project.
Yeah, Byron Slatt.
That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
God, that is fascinating.
It's fascinating. And do you know what? It was really interesting because my dad's an engineer and they're who we just donated $40,000 to. And he said, you know what's so interesting about them? It's people that are young enough, that are naive enough to believe that they can change it, that actually can. And he sees from an engineering perspective, there's a lot of holes in the idea, whereas we see somebody who's willing to work through thousands of holes in this idea to maybe create
a
change.
Their life.
Exactly. And it doesn't bother me if it's not working right now or if the plan to get it to work is potentially not the most engineeringly sound plan. The point is somebody is investing their time in trying to work out how to pull those mountains of trash out of the ocean. And that's worth everything to us and to our customers as well.
What's the most, because this is, yeah, I agree, that whole research, investing in things like R&D or activities that will help a community support itself forever and not rely on you. And in this case, building something that has this massive upside. So you're making these bets that could have massive potential. I feel like that's what I respect about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is they do that really well.
Yeah.
So is there like anything in particular when it comes to plastic and ocean cleanup that interests you the most outside of that young boy as well with the ocean cleanup project?
Yes, I think that there, I mean, for me, it's the idea of probably changing the pitch on the ocean from somewhere that things can go to disappear to something that's vitally essential for our lives. And I think one thing that really interested me coming into it was scientists talk about problems in the ocean and marketers talk to people about products they want to buy. And marketers are much more convincing people than scientists.
Yeah.
And so you got this problem where we know the facts, but the people are protected against them because if they know, they might buy less product and money makes the world go round. So for me, I guess the other thing that I loved about DIRT and part of where the name came from is it's just the essential truth. We make all our decisions that we make, we do it on account of less harm, and the popularity contest kind of falls out of the question in terms of even formula development or the way that we run things. Mm. It's like we take a scientific approach to what we really believe is less harmful, and then we try and tell customers, take them on that journey of why those decisions were made and what junctions they were made at. So even things like using recycled plastic in our packaging, we're trying to work it into it. But right now we can't get the reuse to be sustainable with the recycled plastic at the same time. So our choice is you have a pack that can go time and time and time again, or you have a pack that might go once, twice and fall over because it's made out of a lower quality plastic.
Uh-huh.
These are the kind of decisions that we just bring the customer in a fun and interesting way, or we try to at least. You know, keep them engaged with this is our journey and this is what we're trying to figure out. And we find that there's great interest there for that kind of thing. I mean, a lot of people go, keep going, you'll get there. And we're like, oh, but the science is limiting us.
If only you knew.
I don't know how to get there at this stage. But I think that whole issue of starting to get businesses that really genuinely believe in doing good to maybe fight the voice of companies that are just trying to sell more products. If we can be more clever and more interesting and more transparent about the actual struggle that exists behind the scenes of trying to do something differently, you know, it's that I'd love to see that the dial shift a little bit where there's not such a disparity between the scientific kind of beliefs and community and what consumers know.
Yeah, I agree with that point. Like one of my favourite YouTube channels is Nautilus.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know Nautilus?
No.
It's like a submarine research thing, and they've been going down to that huge space, the Mariana Trench.
Oh, yeah.
And I just find it so fascinating. But the best bit is like their clips.
Yeah, channel. Okay, I'm going to look it up.
So they have like 20 minutes of just clips of them just like geeking out. on whatever. But if you watch the full video, it's so boring.
Yeah.
So, yeah, using more marketing techniques, I guess, to discover that sort of stuff is probably the most exciting way and useful way to do it.
That's why I was interested in TikTok. I'm like, so it's not just comedy. Could we put all our nerdy information on TikTok?
It's funny you mentioned that because there's a girl that I follow. I can't remember her name. She's really kooky. She's obviously like a fashion model and into textiles and stuff, but she'll dress up in a crazy, amazing outfit and do like amazing face makeup or paint or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd expect her to be on some runway in Germany, like some avant-garde type dress or whatever. But really what she talks about is renewable energy, particularly like different types of nuclear and fusion and like hydro and like all this stuff. So like recently she's been doing this thing on TikTok, which has gone viral, is in California they want to shut down this old, Japan old, but 80s era nuclear power plant, which would mean that they would have to integrate coal, which still exists on their system, their electrical system. And she created this campaign about it and like did all these songs and stuff.
Oh, amazing. Because nuclear is one of those things that a lot of scientific community is pro, and it's simply that.
Yeah, I've never got it because my brother and I are really into like electric and recycling, and we were just debating last night, we were trying to buy this car, like are we there yet for buying an electric car? And it's still just not there, like not affordable enough. And we always talk about that. We're completely like sixth generation nuclear power plants that they're now building in China are fascinating because they're next to foolproof. Like it's almost like you know, things like Chernobyl was a first generation nuclear plant, and yes, it happened, but there's only been two events really in the world that has happened like that, that and Fukushima, and Fukushima was a first gen as well.
Yeah, and comparatively to how many people die through coal mining, it's like a blip on what's happened.
The big thing that's often missed with renewables is just the sheer amount of land that is required for... So the way that my brother explained it to me, and we saw this guy talk about it who is really big in the renewable community, is that solar and wind would be like back in the day starting with log fire and then moving to coal fire. It's mass dense versus energy dense. So a nuclear battery like that size of a nuclear battery, the things that go in the actual, you know, system will support me for my entire lifetime. Whereas for like, let's say coal, you would need an entire house full of coal to support you for a lifetime. And so that's the biggest thing that he talks to me about, is that if we are to become an advanced species, we have to become energy dependent, not mass dependent. So, yes, renewables, batteries, et cetera, are going to be part of it. But nuclear and particularly fusion is like the way that we're going to cut all those emissions.
Have you ever read the Whole Earth catalogue?
No, it sort of rings a bell.
I feel like you could have nearly written it.
Really?
It's like piping all the same tunes.
What is that written by?
I can't remember. I'm terrible with authors. I can hardly tell you who Harry Potter was written by. But
J.K. Rowling?
But it is a fascinating argument around energy and very, ultimately pro-nuclear and fusion as well for similar sort of reasons, which is, our fear of it is irrational.
Yeah, the fear of it is totally irrational, and I used to have it as well. And I was fascinated by Chernobyl, like the TV show and the docos and all that. And then my brother and I spoke about it, and he's just like, this is just the wrong way to think about things.
Yeah.
And the thing that he is most concerned with, particularly here in Australia, is when you build these, not so much the solar farms, but the wind farms, they have a big impact on bird life. And we've got a lot of native species that are already struggling. And so if you go build it in a certain area, you're guaranteed to kill like 5% of a certain bird population, he said.
Yeah,
he gave me some sort of statistic. Now, whether that's true, I don't know.
Yeah.
But there's enough TEDx talks that you can watch about people talking. There's one guy, I just can't remember his name, and that's why I feel like that book you mentioned maybe by him, but he's spoken about this in California, because what has happened there, each time they've built like a solar plant, it's impacted the animal that is in that area.
Right.
And oftentimes they resettle them somewhere else and they all just die.
Right.
Because they can't go in that habitat.
Yeah. Because it just takes too much land space to.
Yeah. Because it's the land space is so much. So that's a problem that we currently have with renewables. So that's a really fascinating area. Yeah. Like in Australia could really dominate for nuclear.
Oh, we certainly got space to play with.
Yeah. Lots of space. Like even hydro projects is really interesting. Like, you know, Tassie is a net exporter of energy all year round.
Yeah.
And they have just a massive hydro system.
Yeah.
Which is just literally water flowing.
Yeah, and they got a lot of water.
And they got a lot of water. I got to ask, like, you must get a lot of different topics. The obvious one is probably talking about the whole super yachts thing and discovering, you know, the dirt and all that sort of stuff. But what's the topic that you wish people asked you about? What do you wish you could talk about more in these interviews?
Well, one that I feel would be important to share for people that are starting their own businesses. I mean, one of the reasons we succeeded is our product and our purpose and the way we've delivered it. Timing was a huge part of it, and we had a network of people that wanted to see us succeed. And often I have people that come to me that want business advice. They've got this capital, they've got this idea, and they're going to throw it all together and they're going to launch a business onto the internet, and it's going to be a huge success. And it very well might be, but what was amazing for us without the money is we could feel our way to what the customers wanted, and we could feel our way to success. And I wouldn't change that part of the experience for anything. And I know I wouldn't have got that part of the experience if I had sat down at the beginning and done a calculation on specifically how much I needed to be a successful company. So I guess that would be the only message that I feel like is often overlooked in these conversations or in just podcasts in general, is don't underestimate how when you get traction, you know you're getting traction. And when you have an idea that's good, you know that it's good, because people will take it even if it looks like 70% of what you intended it to look like, or even if you forgot a box, or even if you forgot this, that, and the other, because the idea is good, the timing's right. So it's that whole Silicon Valley mantra, like if you were proud of your first product, you waited too long to launch it. It's that whole thing. The only thing that I would say is the idea is important, the timing is important. The actual execution of that and getting that 100%, for us it wasn't as important, because there's certainly parts of what we did that I am embarrassed about these days. And making sure that you have a strong network around you is really important, because it was hard. It was really hard. And there was times where I just thought, I don't want to do this anymore. It's too hard. You know, I worked for a year and a half without any wage. And, you know, by the end of it, my undy drawer needed just a complete wipe out, because, you know, you shouldn't have the same undies for 5 years in a row, but I couldn't afford anymore.
You can't afford new clothes.
You can't afford new clothes. You can't afford new anything. And so.
Yeah, that's the life.
That was the life, right? Even, we should meet up and talk about business at this cafe. And I think,
no.
What about if we just sat on a park bench and had a coffee instead? So, I mean, that side was tough. Like, obviously, the having no money is tough as well, but it was nice that there weren't kind of investors as well. But, yeah, I would just say just be really careful when you're launching an idea to make sure you have enough room to feel your way through what the successful parts of it are going to be, because if we had just put everything we had into the very first thing of what we launched, we would have missed so much that makes us kind of who we are these days.
Well, it sounds like, so timing you can't really impact.
Yeah.
Like you can, maybe you can convince yourself that I should do this right now versus wait. But at the end of the day, a lot of times you can't. But the network thing, I'm curious what you think there that people can do. And to me, it sounds like generally you're talking about, because you read 30 minutes a night, right? I do a similar thing. I think the only way I've been able to explain it to other entrepreneurs is you just have to be an open and creative person, and you have to always be reading, always coming up with things, giving your brain space to do that and be creative, whether that's through a network or books or whatever.
Yeah.
And that awareness over time will just give you space to work it out.
Yeah.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely the point of the network for me was about taking nuggets of experience from everybody else and chewing them for a little bit and seeing what I could take out of them. And so I did not walk into business with a network of entrepreneurs. No way. I worked my ass off to create that network that I've got now. I used to pick one person that I wanted to speak to every month, and I had to have one important conversation with somebody I didn't know. And so I would send them laundry detergent, and then I would follow up with their assistant. And in the end, you only have to do that a few times before one person can introduce you to another person who knows another person who might be able to help you. And I remember, like, I remember having conversations where people say, "And how'd you get my contact number?" And I'd be like, "Oh, well, that's a long story." But I really worked the chain on that one.
Do you know what? When you say that, now I realize how lucky I am having this podcast, because there's so many people that, like, that we've become friends with or you have relationships that you're just on good terms with that just would not exist if you just said, "Hey, can I grab a coffee or whatever?"
And
sometimes you as well on the network thing, you often, I don't know if you had this, but I overlooked certain people that you had in front of you that you should have been tapping into because they're willing to do it, or they have a perspective that you just, like, I think in particular, Dan Monheit, who runs Hard Hat Agency, has been immeasurably helpful for me. And when I was starting out in this space, I just didn't even think, like, ask him this or that. Yeah. Like, he's open to the discussions. I don't know why I thought that. Maybe I thought he was busy. Maybe, I don't know. I just...
Maybe you thought you were competing, which often turns out you're not.
Maybe, like, maybe I naively thought that.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure I may have thought that initially, which is just ridiculous to think, because he's in a totally another level. But he was me 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And so to have that is... sometimes you just don't realise, and sometimes you just need to sit and think about who those people may be.
I think that's so important, and I think that that's the – there's a lot of great, like, incubators, like StartMate and all the rest that will give you that. But there's a lot of people that have great ideas as well that maybe don't have their presentation polished enough to get into those incubators, or maybe not ready to throw that much commitment into the business at the same time. That doesn't preclude you from accessing those networks. And I think – yeah, for me, I would just say if I hadn't had done that conversation thing, and I really put myself out there and walked into these places and found these people sometimes, and even the first desk that I had, it was because I struck up a relationship with a co-working space across the road because I was a neighbour, and then they gave me a space for free, you know, just all that stuff. And then it turned out there was like 8 other businesses that were at very similar stages to me in that same thing, and we've all grown together through the information that everybody else has. And so things like Facebook advertising, which I mentioned we didn't know about, it wasn't a coincidence that I got that desk at the same time that I learned about all those things. So, yeah, I would say, like, yes, your money is important, and yes, your idea is important, and yes, your execution is important, and those things are well and truly discussed in business kind of podcasts. And but I would also say, don't underestimate the support network you're going to need when the times get tough. The people who are going to have the advice that might just crack open the next door for you and say something so interesting that you're like, oh, that just pacifies that whole chain of,
like,
of
why,
fear.
Why didn't I think about
that? Why didn't I think of that first? And then the other thing is timing. You'll know if you don't have traction. If you've burnt $500,000 and you're not making that in sales, and you can't see where you're going to make it from in sales, then probably I'd say quit early, because traction feels like traction when you've got it and you know about it. So, you know, or just make sure that you have that money behind you to pivot a little bit.
Yeah.
Because people can just stubbornly get caught up on this is what the idea was going to be, and people don't know about it. For us, that pivot was when a customer suggested to us nearly 3 years ago, "Can I refill these packs?"
Yeah, I remember reading that, yeah.
And we were like, oh. Yes, actually, that could be our whole company.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that was awesome, right? And that was our kind of pivot that thankfully, we had enough in our tank to kind of explore that avenue and evolve the next products and everything. So,
yeah,
that'd probably be my two things that I'm like, why does no one ever talk about that?
And that's the snippet. Jacob will probably snippet that for the clip channel. Now, I want to finish off with some rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
I've got to ask now with a new bub, what's sort of the morning and evening routine look like?
Oh, chaos except for Fridays when my partner takes him down to Mornington to get looked after for the day and I lie in bed for the morning. But no,
is that parents?
Yeah, parents help. So it was crazy. Pandemic was crazy. He's 9 months old now.
Mm-hmm.
But it just turns into total chaos. So we actually have quite a good sleeper that wakes up around 7 a.m. and my partner does the baby and I do the dog in the morning. So I'll walk the dog and he'll do the baby, or sometimes we'll do both together. And then at about 8 o'clock, I take over so he can get ready for work. And I'm usually ready for work at that point and I do baby breakfast. And then at about 9 o'clock, that's usually when help kicks in and we go off to work for the day. And then in the evening, I usually finish at like 4:30 so I can do the dinner time feed and play in the bath to bed by 7. Luke usually works through to about 5:30, 6-ish. We have an early dinner together and then we usually jump back online after baby's down, or lately we've been really into Alone on SBS.
Okay.
So that's really
What's that about?
People that get dropped in the wilderness and have to survive.
Ah, that's really interesting. Have you seen 000 on SBS?
No.
It's something that Lauren's parents watched recently. Like, both our families have always really been into SBS. There's some, like, really good international discovery of shows on that, I find.
Oh, it's so good.
That's interesting. Is there any Netflix or other streaming shows you've been watching of late?
Oh, not any that I feel proud of.
You've watched the classic. Oh, okay, so
I watched Emily in Paris.
Yeah, fuck, I was going to say. I couldn't get into it, but I understand why it's good. It's just sort of mindless, easy to watch. You just want to.
It's good while you're cooking.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like while you're doing the washing or something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like
similar,
it for that,
just background noise type thing. And Lauren wanted to watch it, but interestingly, she never really went back into watching it. So maybe that's
the David Attenborough documentary.
Recent one.
Oh yes, the witness statement. That was just incredible.
Yeah,
I would say we watched that. We actually took an afternoon off to watch that, and it was so worth it. And afterwards, we came out.
Haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, you have to watch it. I think, especially if you're interested in kind of, he just boils down the way to kind of turn the tide on the climate issues into just four really easy digestible points. And I think it's not scary. I expected to be really sad, but I felt really like, okay.
We can do this.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out this weekend. Best purchase under $200 in the last year?
Work-wise or generally?
Anything.
Ooh. I'm probably just going to have to stay at my stand-up desk.
Stand-up desk.
Yeah.
What is it?
I'm not sure if it was under $200. So there or thereabouts.
Is it one of those branded ones or just any old? Because we bought an any old one.
Just an any old one,
The same with this thing. You press the button, it goes up, it's good.
Yeah, no, that's been really, really handy for working from home.
Yeah. Last question for you. If you could have a billboard anywhere in the world, where would it be and what would it say?
It would 100% just say clean with dirt. And I'd love to put it just like center of the probably Antarctic, somewhere so
some
random.
Crazy PR campaign.
Yeah, and then we could do a big PR campaign with like, okay, first one to hit our sign wins, and we just start this big trek of all our customers, like whoever can get there first, we'll give you $1 million if you can get there first. But along the way, you have all these like things that you have to do, like you can't create any waste and you can only forage what you find and you have to have all this. Anyway, it's like probably
bring
a whole
on all
other
the
business
shows,
idea.
Bring on all, it's like Spartan Race Antarctica. Exactly. Race Antarctica.
That's 100% it.
Where can people find the refill packs? The standard packs, where can they find you guys on the interwebs?
At www.thedirtcompany.com.au.
Yep. And where are you on? Are you on social media?
Yeah, we're at The Dirt Company and The Dirt Company on both the socials. Hopefully we'll be The Dirt Company on TikTok by the end of the week. I'm feeling inspired. And yeah. So, yeah, we're mostly online. Cool. A few shops dotted around, but easiest online.
Yeah. Frankie, thanks so much for coming in. I apologize so for mixing up your last name.
That's so fine.
And, yeah, guys, go check this out. And thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you do like it, please subscribe. And, of course, like if you're watching the YouTube video as well. We'd really appreciate that. You can also find our Clips channel in the description. For audio, if you're not already listening, you can search Uncommon on Pocket Cast, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts quite easily. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon on YouTube. And for behind the scenes takes and clips on social media, then definitely check out @uncommon_show on Instagram. But otherwise, look, thanks so much for tuning in. And until next time, thanks for listening.